Orthopaedic surgeons are concerned about the backlog of people waiting in pain for surgery after COVID-forced cancellations earlier in the year. The New Zealand Association of Orthopaedic Surgeons says 10,000 patients had their surgery cancelled during Level 4 lockdown in April and into May, and the catch-up is still happening in a system that was already stretched. The association says throwing more money at the problem won't solve the underlying issues. Instead, it wants to see more equitable funding of trauma care, with a greater share of funding going to DHBs with more complex cases. It also wants to see better partnership with the private sector, so private hospitals will pick up the overflow from public hospitals, something recommended in the recently released Health and Disability System Review. Also in its sights, better training for orthopaedic surgeons, a better approach to training orthopaedic surgeons to avoid shortages. Dr. Peter Robertson is president of the New Zealand Association of Orthopaedic Surgeons. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Catherine Ryan. Catherine, thank you for having me on the show.
You're welcome. 10,000 had surgery cancelled during lockdown. Is that overall, does that include a significant proportion of orthopaedic surgeries?
My understanding is that covers all of the elective surgery across the DHBs. Orthopaedic surgery is obviously a significant component of that. And so for your listeners, we're talking mainly about hip replacement, knee replacement, and surgery to other regions of the body, the shoulder, the spine, foot and ankle, knee, and that sort of thing. Orthopaedic surgery doesn't tend to deal with a lot of cancer surgery. That's a small component of it. So our patients are the patients have disorders that can wait, and therefore they occupy a large component of the waiting list system through the public sector.
So how long till that lockdown backlog can be worked through, do you believe? I know it's a bit of a shot in the dark, but are we talking years?
Potentially, yes. There was information that the average wait for surgery has been extended by 50%, and most of the DHBs are trying to get surgery done within this four-month guideline. So, obviously, that takes broadly figures out to 6 months or so. Getting a backlog sorted out is very difficult when your system is running at full capacity as they are at the moment. It's fascinating to see people suggest that if you just throw money, you can have an initiative to clear a backlog, but that's not really possible when the system continues to be at full capacity. There are not hospital beds, operating rooms, anaesthetist surgeons, staff waiting to do this and purely unable to do it because there's not enough money. All of this infrastructure has gradually reduced in comparison to the growth in demand and in comparison, I understand, with funding in relation to overall commercial activity. So there needs to be a look not only at the infrastructure, there needs to be a recognition of the increasing demand with an increasing population, an increasing ageing population, and an increased ability for us to do things to actually make people better. So the Ministry of Health, if we look specifically at the demand, the Ministry of Health have an excellent task force looking at the workforce, and they have done studies across all specialties, but in orthopaedics in particular, that if we continue to produce surgeons at the rate we are, we're going to continue to fall behind in terms of the demand for elective surgery.
So all this has done is illustrate what was already a problem. And to your point, if you've already got a system that's maxed out, trying to work at double overtime in order to clear a backlog, you're flogging a system, aren't you? And the Association of Salaried Medical Specialists has come out this morning with a similar story. You are already working people longer. You are already maxing out, as you say, bed availability. You can't just say, let's just pay more and somehow this backlog will be cleared in 6 months.
Correct. It's interesting that we talk about the partnerships with the private hospitals who have some capacity to work on overload, but of course the COVID shutdown also affected them, and demand in those hospitals is high as well. It is ideal that we have better relationships between the public and the private sector that allow this work to be an ongoing, recognisable work stream. But the other issue that I would like to focus on, if I can, is the funding of acutes, because whilst we're talking about waiting lists for elective procedures in orthopaedic surgery, this is directly affected by acute services.
Let's explain. Let's just explain what we're talking about. So the acute services, this is an emergency response that typically will bump elective procedures, particularly if there's a significant event. Explain how the funding of acute services and or trauma care is affecting electives.
Okay, well, I need to take you back a wee bit. Let's say, Catherine, that you leave the studio and you go down the stairs, you fall down your stairs and you break your leg. It's an accident. The leg's broken below the knee, between the knee and the ankle. When, if we go back 4 or 5 decades ago, when accident compensation started in 1974, you would be taken to hospital, you would be treated with some traction and a plaster would be put on, and you would spend a couple of days in hospital, mobilising the plaster, and you'd be on crutches. And you would commonly have seen people in long leg plaster of Paris casts with crutches mobilising, and they'd have that on for, let's say, 3 months until the fracture healed. Things have changed dramatically over the last 5 decades, and nowadays what happens is that you would go into hospital, you would almost certainly have an operation where a metal rod was placed down the middle of the bone, and you would probably not need a plaster. You would be on crutches for a period of time, but you would soon be weight-bearing, and your return to work would be much more rapid. The result would be much better in terms of movement of the joints above and below, and deformity of the leg would be much less likely. If, however, you had a fracture closer to the ankle joint or closer to the knee joint, again, more complex surgery would be required. And the aim of this is not only to improve healing and prevent deformity, but to prevent arthritis associated with fractures into joints at the knee and the ankle. This requires more complex surgery. The surgical techniques have evolved quite dramatically over the last few decades. And this is not surgery that's done in the middle of the night. It's done in the cold light of day by expert teams. So this sort of acute surgery has flowed into elective times. And, of course, that directly impacts the elective waiting list. Now, it's even more complicated if you have a particularly complicated injury, such as a spinal injury that might be referred to the spinal units at Burwood and Christchurch, at Middlemore and Auckland, a pelvic injury or complex hand trauma. These will go to specialised units. Now, the funding mechanism that pays for that acute surgery, which is all performed in the public hospital, is a relatively historic mechanism and has not at all kept pace with the intensity of the complexity of the surgery, the costs of the surgery, the frequency of the surgery, but it's having a huge effect on the public hospital system. So in my position, we see the elective lists that were perhaps maximally dominated by elective patients are now being intruded upon by these complex acute surgeries. It's more complicated if you live in a referral, tertiary referral institution, the big centres. These cases that are complex get referred to those centres. So the patients on the elective waiting list in those centres are disadvantaged by the skills available in the tertiary centres.
So what would change that? Do you need to fund the acute surgery better so that it is staying in its lane funding-wise? Is it about funding of acute surgery, or is it about capacity and availability for elective?
It's about both. The capacity for acutes needs to be increased. And it's very easy for us to just say we need more money, but there is a potential solution because the funding for acute surgery is performed in the first 7 days after accident is performed through ACC by what's called FAS, the Public Hospital Acute Services Payment. Now, this is a payment that's made at a governmental department level. There's a broad calculation of what the costs of acute services might be, and ACC, I believe, it's a complex pathway. ACC pay Treasury, pay the Ministry of Health, who then distribute the money through the DHBs on the population-based funding mechanism. So at no stage when you've fallen down the stairs and broken your leg and you go to hospital and require surgery, does an itemised bill or invoice get created? Do people understand the real costs, and does that bill go to ACC? There's a more general coverage of funding from ACC eventually through.
So unlike most ACC cases where I go off to a physio and fill out a form and I'm funded for X number of physio treatments, ACC doesn't pay for my specific injury. It pays a block sum that makes its way through to the DHB. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Now, that's not precise, is it?
Historical calculation.
Right. So that's not precise, is it? So is what you're saying over time, the gap between what is being spent by ACC, what is being paid by ACC, and what actually it should be paying, were we working this out case by case, a gap has opened up?
A substantial gap has opened up.
It's been estimated, hasn't it?
You're exactly right.
It's been estimated.
Yes.
What is it?
Well, again, it's only an estimate because the public hospitals don't have a high degree of accuracy both with the coding of the cases and with the itemisation of the charging of the cases. So estimates and cases are coded in general groups, which don't at all represent the specificity and the complexity of any surgery that's performed or care provided. The funding, therefore, never follows the case. The Canterbury DHB have done some estimates on what the real cost of their acute services are on an annual basis, and then they've compared that with a calculation of the FAS, which is the ACC payment via those mechanisms to the DHB, and the estimates are that it's a little over half of the real cost. So the annual cost of acute services in the Canterbury DHB last 3 years is around $90 million, yet the $90 million, and the funding is about $50 million. So we're looking at a little more than 50% of the real cost is being funded. Now, if you expand that across the DHBs across the country, you start to get a number that is not totally inconsistent with the debt of the DHB. So it's a huge issue and a huge burden that's gone on to the DHBs of underfunding acute service, which, of course, then has its flow-on effects, as I've outlined, into the elective services.
So we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars a year?
We are.
If that were to be changed, what would be the effect? Well, for start, as you said, we might see some DHB debt reduced. How would it also assist with the provision, availability and timeliness of elective surgery? If the acute surgery were funded more fully by ACC, or perhaps followed a true funding follows the person model,
yes.
How would that improve the entire system apart from relieving financial pressures?
Well, that's exactly what it would do, relieve financial pressures and allow development of the other two strings, which is, of course, improvement of your infrastructure, increasing of your beds, theatres and staffing for your electives, and also increasing in your training to look at this increase in training required to deal with population, ageing and ability to do things for people.
What is the reality of that trajectory? We know we're living longer. We know that people can be on to multiple joint replacements in their lives, knees and hips particularly. Is the Health Ministry itself and are the DHBs tracking where this is heading and what demand is going to be like?
The Health Ministry has, as I mentioned, the workforce assessments with a very good work done by the Ministry of Health has shown the trouble that we're heading for. And we will be way less able to provide the current level of services if we're not training more surgeons and building the infrastructure to employ those surgeons. All very well to say, okay, let's train more people. We're already training the maximum number that we can in the positions available in the hospitals around New Zealand, and that's supervised by our association, the training of the younger surgeons to come to consultant level. It's all very well to say you can train more, but they need to have positions of employment, and you can't have a position of employment without the infrastructure, the beds, the operating rooms to employ them. So we are heading towards an ongoing downturn in the system. It's always a crisis point. COVID has exacerbated this when your infrastructure is stretched to the limit.
What of the public-private partnerships? There is already a relationship of sorts between the private hospitals and the public sector when it comes to taking overflow. It's been controversial in the past because often the public system becomes underfunded and the private system, essentially picks up from what should be, or picks up public funding as a result of the backlogs that build. So it becomes a bit of an argument about the relationship between the two. What do you believe would be optimal at the moment, and how far are we from it?
Philosophically, there are different viewpoints on this, and we certainly recognise that. It has to be done in what you call a win-win situation. You can't expect the public hospitals, which are businesses, the private hospitals, which are businesses, to run at a loss when doing public work. But also, you can't expect them to make unreasonable profit out of the public sector. By using spare capacity, if I've got an operating list that's three quarters full and I can add an extra case, and there's a relatively straightforward way of doing this, of bringing people that are on the waiting list in the public sector across to the private, to do that, it improves the efficiency of the day in the private sector, it takes people off the public list, and therefore reduces the wait for others. Some criticise the possibility that the private hospitals might so-called cherry-pick the more straightforward, more profitable cases out of the public sector. But with careful planning, that doesn't happen to a great degree. But even if it does happen, it still allows us the capacity to deal with the more complex cases, which perhaps need the greater support through the public sector. So most of the surgeons in my position work in both centres and can see advantages for both the public hospital, public patients on the waiting list, and the private hospitals to agree. And it's all about improving efficiency.
One email has just emailed in and said, look, part of the reason there's a problem clearing the backlog of the public system is that no surgeons work full time in the public health system. Is that part of the problem?
Surgeons work as much as they can in the public system. So the public system is maxed out to capacity, and all of the surgeons you're dealing with are not the rate limiting factor. The surgical drive of efficiency that is experienced in the private sector is certainly driven through as much as possible into the public sector. So no, that's not a valid system, not a valid complaint. I think in terms of if you look at systems around the world, fully public systems tend to have relatively low efficiency and output and long waiting lists. If you look obviously the opposite, fully private systems do tend to overservice and be very expensive. And the mixture of the two that allows most surgeons to work well within both systems optimises the outcomes. We spend our days looking at seeing how we can optimise getting through the patients on the waiting list in private. If you made all surgeons full-time public, make no difference because there's no capacity to do the work, and that's that infrastructure and capacity.
So you're saying that surgeon availability is not an issue at all in the public sector at the moment?
Surgeon availability is exceptionally uncommon as an issue.
What of the Heather Simpson review, the Health and Disability Sector review, massive review, has it addressed this issue? It was talking about a two-tier network. Did that start to look like a system you're talking about?
It seemed, my reading of it, it seemed to take away some of the role from the Ministry of Health. And perhaps not directly answering your question, but at the moment we see a disconnect, or there's our observation is that there's a relative disconnect between the Ministry of Health and the DHBs trying to provide the service.
That's an understatement on a few matters at the moment, isn't it?
Well, it is. I'm trying to be polite about it. But you know, when the elective services were stopped during Alert Level 4 at COVID, it didn't seem apparent, or waiting list services, for the sorts of things that we do in orthopaedics, it didn't seem apparent that the Ministry of Health were fully aware of all of that, and we had to lobby to make sure that when we got back to Alert Level 3, we could get back to doing elective cases as quickly as possible. So there is a wee bit of a disconnect there, and as you say, it's not just confined to this. I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment on the planned reorganisation and whether that will solve the problem. Our approach to advocacy in this area is to obviously comment on the running down of the infrastructure, to provide helpful approach for funding with the acutes, because we do believe that ACC are underfunding the acutes, as mentioned. ACC in our interactions with them accept this.
Is it as straightforward as making it, as it is for a simple sports injury, the funding follows the person rather than a bulk funding? Is that change practicable? Or will it lead to other unintended consequences?
That's an excellent question. And so the unintended consequence would be that you wouldn't want the potential savings or funding increase to be fully taken up in some form of accounting system, costing out everything. You could potentially build huge administrative department that might take away that funding. But
you also end up with a concentration of surgeons and surgeries in some parts of the country and others struggling to even get, to get surgery done. Because I presume there's an element of, well, there is a population-based approach to this.
Yes. At the moment we have a concentration in surgeons with the population, and the more subspecialty expertise that occurs in those areas. But if you have the, as you correctly point out, and you use the sports medicine analogy, but if you have the money following the patient, then that actually allows the funding to appropriately go to the centres doing the difficult work, and that therefore allows them to increase their ability to provide services, and so that complex acute work is not to the detriment of the public hospital waiting list patients waiting for elective surgery.
On the question of rationing, just to use a word that no one ever likes using in health, but it's a daily reality, with the projected increase in orthopaedic demand, longer lifespans, more and more hip and joint work needed and replacements needed, how do we approach the question of rationing from the perspective of the overall benefit to the system? And could you explain the difference that it can make sometimes to a person, ageing or otherwise, but particularly if they're ageing, to get a joint done as opposed to carrying on with what they've got? Is it not only a personal cost, but could you argue that the system ends up paying another way anyway?
So, obviously, rationing is a way of saying we want people to live with pain and disability. In the elective situation, many times that will lead to, from an orthopaedic perspective, greater progression of the disease condition and therefore a more complex situation to try and recover when the patient makes a threshold that has been introduced by the rationing process. So we talk about scoring on our national system of scoring. You have to get to a threshold. So if you have a high threshold, the problems are more complicated and more difficult to deal with at that time.
By the time you get to them,
That produces puts further burden on the system.
Well, beyond that, Peter, if you say to someone you're not having your third replacement, do you then find often that person's general health and well-being and needs is so impacted that the system will end up paying financially. They're paying, certainly, in personal pain and discomfort. But do you end up with a false economy by taking that approach?
Well, absolutely. Absolutely. And so people become increasingly disabled. They become increasingly reliant on family, carers and institutions. So you're transferring one problem to another. And where possible, I mean, we try and provide the most, not only cost-effective services, but services that provide the best disability reduction.
Peter,
we can do that at optimum times before patients get much more progressed in the state of their disease. And it's those patients that are going to provide greater burdens. And what I'm talking about here is perhaps the difference between a straightforward joint replacement, maybe an hour and a half in the operating room, versus a very complicated reconstruction, twice that length of time. The burden on the system becomes greater if you ration at too high a threshold.
So at the moment, then, you've got a trajectory that's tracking in a way that's not funded, that's not actually optimally organised for funding, and that doesn't have enough surgeons being trained. If ACC has acknowledged that it is underfunding the acutes, is it volunteering to do anything about that? And who should?
Catherine, you're talking politically now, and it would require a big change. I mean, the magnitude of the problem has only become apparent to us in the last couple of years. We liaise with ACC. They're aware of a problem. There's more issues to it than that, because ACC really not only don't fund those acute services, but they don't have oversight of what's actually occurring and the quality of care that's occurring. So if the acute services are poor, and you will have obviously talked in the past and interviewed people about waiting for acute services, people fracture their hip, they wait 2 or 3 days for surgery, the quality of surgery is delayed, the quality of the outcome is definitely impaired, and increased morbidity and mortality occurs. ACC don't have oversight of the quality of work that's being done for their patients who suffer personal injury by accident. So it's unusual, shall we say, that you've got a body, ACC, paying indirectly for work to be done for their patients and clients, and yet they have little oversight of it. And so their ability to drive the system is limited. When we talk to ACC, they recognise this. It seems to be that there's not really a big will to change, but then I don't think up until now it's been well recognised that how significant the underfunding is and how there's this disconnect from the people who should be providing the care to the people who are.
You mentioned the politics. I'm sure we'll be back, perhaps not with you, but with some other people talking about the District Health Board deficit. Again, it might be an opportunity to talk to others about whether there is another solution to those deficits as well. Thanks very much. Peter Robertson is President of the New Zealand Association of Orthopaedic Surgeons. The Ministry of Health says in a statement, District Health Board waiting lists for planned care surgical procedures, specialist appointments and radiology scans are not where we want them to be. It acknowledges that COVID-19 has had a significant impact on District Health Board's ability to deliver planned care services. Since lockdown, it says the health system has increased inpatient surgical discharges for the months of June and July. DHB's delivered 107%, that is 7% more surgical discharges of the inpatient discharges delivered in those same months last year. And the Ministry says DHB's received an increase in funding for planned care of $31.35 million a year and a one-off boost of $282.5 million over the next 3 years in this year's budget.